Fall into a workout routine this season at Crunch Fitness. With everything from heavy weights to heart-pumping group classes, find your mode for as low as $9.99 a month. And now, through September 30th, go Crunch mode for $0 down. Sign up today at crunch.com or stop by your local Crunch in Lancaster.
I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network. It's a great pleasure to welcome Henry Trix of The Economist, writing most recently, as The Economist magazine is, of the significant development in Atlanta, Georgia, over CEOs speaking out about politics. This is about politics in general. It's not particular to an outcome of the speaking out. It's the fact that it happened. And what I learned from Henry and his colleagues at The Economist is that these developments have history. We're seeing CEOs or companies enter in or step away from politics over generations. And there are results, and probably we're witnessing another transformation. Henry, a very good day to you. You are in Great Britain. I am in the United States. However, we observe that limited liability companies are at the ground level of companies participating or not in politics. What is the understanding of limited liability companies stepping away from politics in the 20th century? Good evening. Good day to you, Henry.
Good day to you, John. It's fantastic to be on the show. Thanks very much for having me. And let me kick off by saying that companies' involvement in politics is clearly a feature of life in America and elsewhere in the world. And you know, it always has been. There's always been a link through either lobbying or cronyism or other means, revolving doors, in which you know businesses have exchanged ideas and put pressure on politicians. To a certain extent, it's an inevitability that can't be changed. But what I find very interesting, looking through the history of the history of corporate America, was just how there was an attempt in the mid-19th century to try and separate business from politics as best as possible. And this was because part of the very early history of American capitalism was built around a corporate form which was called the Chartered Company. And the Chartered Company needed legislative approval in order to exist. And it needed politicians to keep on giving it the right to continue in business. And of course, in order to acquire that charter, or in order to prevent potential competitors from getting a charter and wiping you out, you had to grease the wheels somewhat. So there was a lot of money being exchanged and favors being done under the table in order to get the right to do business. The limited liability company, especially once it became publicly funded, did not need that charter. And it had a right to exist in perpetuity, so it didn't depend on the good graces of politicians for its existence. And though the cronyism continued, especially deep into the early part of the 20th century, that corporate form itself, which has been described as one of the tremendous inventions of American capitalism, has actually served American firms incredibly well and has underpinned a lot of the dynamism that we've seen historically in the American company. So it's something that you meddle with with some jeopardy.
And then we had the period where General Motors ruled the solar system, Electric Charlie Wilson, the dollar a year man. And that was clearly entering into politics because you were participating in large decision making, either the New Deal or I'm thinking particularly of the arsenal of democracy in the Second World War. Those celebrity CEOs dominated the conversation until along comes an economist named Milton Friedman. How did he change it, Henry?
Well, he, as you say, he arrived at a time when the CEO was really the CEO statesman. You know, that whole post-war period was a period in which businesses were engaged in every aspect of society. They built villages, they built golf courses, they offered their workers jobs for life. And the idea was that they reinforced their status as CEOs through their largesse as well as through through their business acumen. I love the fact that you mention engine Charlie Wilson. There was also electric Charlie Wilson as well, who was the General Electric one. Both of those were at different times in the 40s and 50s involved in different administrations. So it was a period in which corporations were very big. There was what what J.K. Galbraith called countervailing power, in which big business, big unions and big governments kind of offset each other. And Milton Friedman threw, in a sense, a dose of cold water on this and applied a very simple principle, which was that businesses were in business in order to benefit their owners, that is, their shareholders. That was their primary fiduciary responsibility. And out of that, other good things would come, like more economic dynamism, more jobs, better served consumers and more social prosperity. So his influence was very profound 50 years ago, and it's been very much part of the landscape in America, the corporate landscape in America, since really the 1980s, since the Reagan era. The mantra has been shareholder capitalism. It's created, in a sense, the cult of the CEO. The CEO became really, really a celebrity in the 90s when people could see how their share prices were soaring as a result of supposedly excellent management. So this was, I suppose, when shareholder capitalism reached its apex. It's changed since really the start of the 21st century. We're in a bit of a different era now, I think.
Before we go on to the era of the 21st century, I want to mention one celebrity CEO who wandered into politics and became what today is a tragedy, which is Robert McNamara of Ford Motor Company. He was asked by John Kennedy in 1960 to head up the Department of Defense. And you know that the Vietnam War and the Cuban Missile Crisis all was ahead of us in the 1960s. And I'm wondering if that disappointment, that tragedy, and eventually he'd go on to lead the World Bank, and eventually he'd go on to mea culpa toward the end of his life about decisions he made in Vietnam. I wonder, did that change the public's perception of the use of these technocrats, these men who ran large companies?
Yes, I think there was a realization that they'd overstepped their bounds. As we alluded to earlier, businessmen are not electives. And it is, in a sense, dangerous to believe too much in their potential to transform not just companies, but society more broadly. Having said that, there were other examples in the 60s where businessmen operated quietly behind the scenes in very positive ways. One of those was the involvement of Coca-Cola when Martin Luther King won the Nobel Peace Prize. He was due to come back to Atlanta, his hometown, but the high and mighty of Atlanta weren't initially prepared to offer him a congratulatory dinner. Behind the scenes, the top executives of Coca-Cola began to talk quietly to their fellow industrialists, saying, look, guys, this is just going to be such a terrible embarrassment to the city if we don't recognize Dr. King as one of our own. And so the dinner went ahead, and it was a very important moment, I think, in history. It wasn't something that Coca-Cola shouted about at the time, but I think there have been both good and bad examples of businessmen being involved in politics.
I'm speaking with Henry Trix of The Economist magazine. We're discussing a leader in The Economist some days past, but also the general understanding of big corporation businesses with their CEOs entering into political conversation. We're going to come back to the 21st century. We're going to center this again, talking about the decision made by a number of corporations following the disorder in voting questions in Georgia, but also Jamie Dimon, the celebrity CEO and a man who weighs in on politics all this time, and something that we don't notice but is quite politically acute, which is the Business Roundtable. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show.